Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is a special edition of Franchise Today. Our very special guest today is Aziz Hashim, chairman of the International Franchise Association. Known to many in franchising as the managing partner of NRD Capital Management, based in Atlanta, Georgia, Aziz assumed chairmanship of the IFA earlier this year during the association's 56th annual convention. As a longstanding IFA member and advocate and mentor to the franchise industry at large, Aziz has held many leadership positions in the association throughout his career. Prior to his appointment to chairman, he had been a member of the IFA Board of Directors since 2011, had been very active in a variety of roles of the association, including serving on the Board of Directors, the Franchise Foreman, and chairing the Strategic Planning Committee and the Convention Committee. During the past 6 months as chairman, Aziz has been spearheading efforts to address the challenges facing franchising today and, of course, tomorrow. My co-host Stan Friedman attended recent franchise events where Aziz addressed the attendees. Stan, what would you like to share with us? Set the foundation, so to speak, as we welcome Aziz to Franchise Today.
Paul, before I do that, I'm actually going to step back one half step from there and say that I'm not only happy and delighted to have the opportunity for us to talk with Aziz today, but I'm doing something that we seldom get to do with our guests, Paul. I'm sitting in the same room with Aziz as he's here with us at home base at FRM Solutions today in Atlanta. So not only do we get the pleasure of the wisdom that Aziz will share, and as Brian Schnell calls them at his summit, the nuggets that this man is going to bring to our audience, I'm getting to do it face-to-face. Aziz, welcome and happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Paul, I think the big thing that I get from Aziz, one is personal and the other one is professional. On the personal side, I've always heard it said that when you want something done, give it to a busy person. And this is probably one of the busiest people I've ever known who always seems to find a way to take on just a little bit more. And I've found that with Aziz in more ways than I can recount in the time we've got here. But I think that on the professional side, what I've found is there's more than one way to skin a cat. And where IFA for years has been doing battle with some of the forces that have opposed franchising, we've tried to act like prize fighters, and we've tried to box our way out of a situation that maybe would be easier to do with a little jujitsu. And I think what Aziz has helped IFA in his tenure as chairman do is look for ways to better communicate the positive message of franchising and help communicate some of the things about franchising that go beyond asking most people what they think a franchise is and you get an answer like, you know, it's a Big Mac. There's a lot going on that we do as a business model and with franchising gives back, with some of the initiatives that we've really been investing heavily as an organization, IFA, to communicate this year. I put a lot of that on the wisdom of Aziz to take a directional change in how we communicate what franchising is and isn't to even our own employees, Aziz, which was an amazing message I heard as you took the gavel, that your own employees were somewhat confused as to who they worked for and who the boss was and what the business model was about. Why don't we start, before we dive into all that, Paul, by doing what we usually do and peel the onion back a little and ask Aziz if he would help us better understand how it is you even got into this fast-paced business of not just quick serve, but franchising as well. Where did it all start for you, Aziz?
Well, that story started, you know, at the ripe age of 14 when my family decided to move to Los Angeles from London, England, which is where I spent most of my childhood. So as a young child, that was a very sort of at that age at 14, that's always a difficult move for a teenager to leave everything behind and go to a completely new land. But you know, it was it's an amazing transformation for me to have lived in the European system and then moved to the U.S. And upon coming here, you know, my dad really didn't have anything lined up. We just decided to move because we had a lot of family here. And right soon as we landed, one of my uncles had just purchased a Burger King restaurant. He was a CPA, and he purchased it from one of his clients. Of course, after he purchased it, he was trying to figure out who's going to run this thing because he's an accountant and not an operator. So seeing as that my dad was temporarily available, he asked my dad to come in and help, and my dad had a lot of business experience from the past. So my dad agreed, and so I came along for the ride, sort of free labor. and I cut my teeth mopping the floors and wiping tables and cleaning bathrooms at Burger King restaurant. And wound up spending the next 8 years. So all through high school and all through college, I wound up working at not only that Burger King, but other Burger Kings. And so by the time I graduated with a degree in electrical engineering, which is what I thought were my dream was, I had actually had 8 years of fast food experience. And during that time, I even had the privilege of having flown to Miami at Burger King headquarters at the time and taking their courses and graduating from Burger King University, or Whopper University as they called it. And so you know, really, it was really 8 years of very detailed in the fast food arena. So upon getting that job as an electrical engineer upon graduation, I quickly realized, in fact, within 90 days, that a cubicle life was not for me. So while I really appreciated that I had a very, very good job in Newport Beach, California, like, what else could you ask for? You know, I had an apartment near the ocean. It was sort of game, set, and match here. Everything was done, except I wasn't happy in that 6x6 cubicle. And so after 90 days of trying that, I decided to call it quits. And I informed my parents, actually, after I made the resignation. And they were very, very supportive. And I think that was really an inflection point, one of many in life. But when your parents back you up, when you make a major decision that, you know, you're not entirely sure whether it's the right decision or the wrong decision, but your parents are behind you, I think that gives you a lot of confidence. So after quitting the electrical engineering job after 90 days, I decided that I really wanted to just do fast food because that's what I liked. I had done it for 8 years, and I missed the hustle, the bustle, working with teams, serving customers, and sort of seeing a direct impact of your work every day. As an engineer, you're sometimes just a cog, a small cog in a very, very big wheel. But in fast food, boy, it is, you know, it is shift by shift. You know whether you're going to make it or not every hour. And I really missed the hustle and bustle of that life. So I tried to establish myself in various ways in California. I was still in the L.A. area because I went to school at UC Irvine after having gone to high school in Los Angeles. But things weren't working out. So my sister invited me to come to visit Atlanta, where she had moved earlier with her husband. So I decided to take her up on that offer, and I came to Atlanta in 1995 in the summer just for a week, just kind of check it out and see what was going on. And I fell in love with it. In fact, I never went back home. I never used the return portion of the ticket. I called my wife. We had a six-month-old daughter at the time. I said, you know, I'm going to stay here for a while. And again, you know, it's really interesting in life. You have to understand and appreciate the people who were there for you at very important times. And you know, my sister and my brother-in-law, her husband, kept me in their house for 6 months, which is an immensely generous, you know, gesture. So I didn't have any expenses for, you know, staying here and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And that was a really important phase because if I had, for example, had to live in hotels and all that, you know, that expense would not have worked out. So when I was bumping around downtown Atlanta in late 1995, before the Olympics, which were 1996, of course, I realized that there was no KFC in downtown Atlanta. And I made a cold call to KFC Corporation. And first they said, no, you know, we're a corporate market. We're not really interested in franchisees at the moment. But then they called back 2 days later and said, you know, we have a proposal for you. If you can open a store before the Olympics, we will grant you a one-store license. And, of course, what would I say as a 20-something-year-old with no money, no credit? No, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I'll have it done for you, folks. No worries. And so I signed up for that. And, you know, as fortune would have it, I was not able to open it by the Olympics because 2 weeks before the Olympics, the Secret Service closed down all the streets to truck traffic for security reason, and I couldn't get my air conditioning unit installed. So that was sad, but I got it open for the Paralympics 2 weeks later. So that was fine. KFC was very generous. Obviously, they did not cancel the license because I couldn't meet that deadline because they knew it wasn't my fault. But that was the beginning. So we opened the first KFC store. using money that my parents loaned me. They kind of mortgaged their house and gave me their life savings, which was an immense, again, another immense risk on their part, and that I convinced a bank to give me the balance of the loan, et cetera. I convinced a landlord to to sign the lease with me, having no credit, and I told them, I'll give you a personal guarantee, and they just looked at me and said, yeah, but you have nothing. It's not worth anything. So thank you, but, you know, but you know, those are the things. And I mentioned recently in a talk I gave about, you know, how important it is to, you know, to give people a chance, because so many people give you a chance during your life. And so, but I got that first one open by hook or by crook. Thankfully, it was in downtown Atlanta, so a captive audience. And the store turned out to be very successful, and that opened the door for me to then expand. Obviously, KFC gave me future licenses, and so I was able to expand that business. But what I did very early on was I decided to do multi-branding. I always felt that that was something that was right for me. I didn't like the risk of having all the eggs in one basket, so to speak. So I right away got involved with other brands, and over the course of time, built a nice little you know, enterprise, and at one point was the 34th largest franchisee in America. So we had gotten it to
across multiple brands.
Yeah, across multiple, 34th largest multi-unit restaurant franchisee, et cetera. So that was a really good experience. So we did multiple brands. We went to multiple states, did international as well, had stores in Toronto, Canada, had some investments in South Africa, et cetera. So really did become a global enterprise as well. And then the recession hit in 2008 or 9, and that was really a big turning point for me, because what I saw during the recession was sort of the dark side of franchising, and I saw behaviors by franchisors and some franchisees as well that I felt were just not healthy for our business model. And to give an example would be, you know, some extreme enforcements of policies that usually were sort of written in franchise agreement but never intended to be executed upon, for example, liquidated damages.
Sure.
During the recession, many people had to close their stores due to the, you know, we all remember how awful that period was. Sales were down terribly, and then franchisors, you know, felt that, some of them felt that they had to enforce liquidated damages and, you know, just putting people into bankruptcy and things like that. But I also saw franchisors during that time cut back on services to franchisees. I remember one brand, which I obviously will not mention. The franchise consultant came to me and said that, Aziz, they have just made my span 200. So in the next year, I may or may not be able to come see your stores even once. And that one, and I remember asking them, I said, you know, doesn't your company derive most of its revenue from royalty? He said, yes. I said, are they cutting back the spans on their corporate stores at all? He said, not at all. The corporate G&A is going to remain exactly the same. They're cutting it all on the franchisee side. And I said, that is just not acceptable. That's ridiculous. You know, so I saw some of those behaviors, and I felt that, you know, something needed to change in franchising. So at that point, I started getting involved. So I joined the IFA, for example, in 2009. I joined Multi-Unit Franchise Conference and other groups. Up till then, I was like the typical franchisee, kind of just buried in my own business, head down, expansion, just, you know, creating opportunities, hiring people, building locations. It was all good. Then I felt that, you know, I really need to give something back here and help educate a little bit on the merits of franchising to others. So
I remember, Aziz, when I first met you, and it's going back some years, when you were speaking at one of the Southeast Franchise Forum programs for us. But I remember then that you were brand agnostic. You weren't really the brand guy. You were actually, you had a formula, as I remember.
Yeah.
That you use to acquire and to divest without any heart or that side of the brain. It was all an emotion. The emotional thing was parked on the shelf. It was all about economics, getting in and getting out at the right time. That changed too somewhere along the way. How did that formula
evolve? I attribute a lot of that, Stan, to sort of the electrical engineering background. You know, when you're trained as an engineer, whether I use that degree professionally or not, but you don't take away what you learned. And so as an engineer, I mean, you know, there's the old, you know, the stereotypical engineer are sort of agnostic. They're black and white. They don't really, you know, it's all about the facts, right? It's not no emotion when you're building, an airplane. You don't get emotional about whether you like this design or that design. It's the design that works. And so, therefore, I think part of that kicked in. And my view towards brands was that if we all agree that the economy has a cycle, and we all agree that brands have and organizations have cycles because they do, right? And we've seen some it's epic cycles. Like we saw, for you would remember, McDonald's was almost down and out for the count. I mean, people had written that brand off, and then within 10 years, their AUVs doubled. New management came in, and they added the coffee and the remodeling and whatnot. So if brands have cycles and the economy has cycles, I could never fathom why I would have to stay with a brand for an entire 20 years if I signed a 20-year franchise agreement. If there was a time where the brand was not going in the right direction, I felt that I owed it to myself and my team to then exit that brand at an appropriate time. And sometimes, you know, it's not even the brand, it's your personal cycle. If you've done as much as you can and you lose a passion for a particular brand, it's time you exit and let somebody else come in and do whatever they can do and take the business to the next level. And I have sold businesses where someone has come in and done much better than I did, and I welcome that, and I'm happy for them. I'm glad that they were able to inject some new life into it. But for me, for example, in one case, I was in a brand for 8 years, and I just didn't have any more juice in me for that brand, you know?
Right.
But I sold it to somebody, they came in, they just knocked it out of the park, and I was so happy for them. So that's where this system of sort of entries and exits came in. It was, I looked at my own cycle, my company cycle, the brand cycle, the economic cycle, and wherever I felt that we had topped out on a particular brand, we would use the sort of buy low, sell high theory, and we would get out wherever we thought it was the best for us, and good luck to whoever comes after us, but we're done, and then we move on to other brands where we could similarly inject a new breath of life, you know?
Pretty amazing transition, though, Paul, don't you think, from a guy who was in the world of black and white all the time as an engineer,
yeah,
going not just to gray, but shades of gray,
mm,
is what we live with in franchising, yeah, all the time. In the second half of our program, Aziz, we're going to talk more about all the amazing work you're doing to help protect the brand of franchising and your role as chairman of IFA. But before we get to that point, I want to continue to unpack your career and how you've evolved into the multi-unit czar, I mean, quick serve czar, and then on from there to become involved not just as a multi-unit franchisee, but to start putting together capital investment to acquire franchising and become a franchisor. I mean, you've done the trifecta in this business.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've worn every hat one can wear.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you walk us further and take us a little further?
Sure.
You left off with doing service became important to you.
Yeah.
And so there was a bit of a paradigm shift there. And
yeah.
How did that move forward?
Yeah. So the other thing that happened was that, you know, after the recession, multi-unit franchising really began to grow because a lot of brands, you know, during down periods, undercapitalization, as we all know, is one of the big risks in business. And a lot of brands made a decision that they only want large multi-unit franchisees to deal with. And so that's great, and that allowed a lot of people like me to grow very, very quickly. But it also created some very sophisticated organizations, right? So today, can you imagine today that the top five or six largest franchisees in America have billion-dollar businesses? I mean, that would be unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I gave a stat to someone the other day that if you take the top 200 franchisees in America, their net worth, their system enterprise value is like the 15th or 16th largest country in the world.
Amazing.
I mean, it is a massive number, you know? And so what was happening was that as multi-unit franchisees were getting bigger, two or three things became apparent. Number one is that it's very hard for an emerging brand. Let's say a brand's got 50 units or 75 units or even 100 units, and they're trying to get a franchisee to sign up for their system, and that franchisee may actually be bigger than the company, you know? But yet, their approach to those franchisees was exactly the same, as if they were a one-unit operator, right? And so this was very frustrating for a lot of multi-unit franchisees. They would come to me and say, you know, I went to see so-and-so company, and they've got four employees on the payroll, this brand does, and I've got 75 in my back office, and somehow they treat me as if I'm doing, you know, they're doing me a favor. There's something backwards here, you know? So I was hearing that a lot. That was number one. Number two, the proliferation of brands after the recession meant that, and I saw a stat yesterday from Fran Data, I think it was, that there's one new brand that started every single day. So 365 brands a year. Now, you can imagine with that many new brands coming, how difficult it would be for the average franchisee to underwrite, right? Like, how do you even know what's for real and what's not for real? There is no clearinghouse or standards for franchising,
yeah,
right? You have to do your own research, which is fine, but I often give the example, if you want to buy a washing machine, you can go spend $5 and buy a copy of Consumer Reports and get every review, every statistic you need to know on every washing machine that's available and make an informed decision. Where does that exist in the world of franchising? Well, I'll give you the answer, nowhere. No one does that type of comprehensive third-party review, right? So that's the second thing that was missing. The third thing is a lot of us multi-unit franchisees realize that if you're going to be in the business of franchising, it's or any investment, you should have money spread out into different areas of that industry. So in our case, no matter, even if you have 1,000 units as a franchisee, it's still a royalty-paying side of the business. Shouldn't you not have some investments in the royalty collection side of the business? And that's an argument that I started making to a lot of multi-unit franchisees, and I said, you know what, you're right. If we're going to be in franchising, you know, we ought to really have some money invested on the other side of the trade, as we call it. But it's hard to do that, right? Because there's only a handful of franchises that are publicly traded that you can go and buy some stock in. Most brands are loathe to have franchisees be investors in their brand. I mean, they are loathe. They call it a conflict of interest, and probably is, right? You wouldn't want a franchisee to have a shares in a franchisor. Then others could make the argument that they got preferential treatment because they're an owner. So it brings all kinds of problems. So what I thought is, why don't we create a fund where indirectly multi-unit franchisees can invest in the fund. The fund will go out and buy franchisors. So now you are investing on the other side of the trade, and you are in the royalty collection business, albeit indirectly, but you legitimately are. And so that resonated with a lot of brands. At the same time, we will only buy brands that are franchisee-centric. That is, we'll provide the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. So if NRD Capital makes an investment in a franchise brand, one thing is for sure, it's a legitimate brand. Now, your success or your failure as a franchisee is predicated on your effort and your diligence and all that, but we're not going to be investing in brands that are bad deals for franchisees. So we're going to do this kind of clearinghouse, be this Good Housekeeping seal of approval in the franchising space. So that was sort of the second reason why it made sense to start a fund. And the third thing was a lot of multi-unit franchisees are involved in legacy brands where there's no more expansion room. So if a large franchisee is going to sign a development agreement with an emerging brand, it's kind of nice that they have part ownership in that brand, and the fund allows you that. And then we give our existing franchisee investors in our fund first look. So whenever we buy a brand, the first chance to sign a development agreement goes to our existing investors in our brand, in our fund. So that's a really nice, you know, compelling business case. So put all that together and is born the NRD Capital Fund. And we go out and we start making investments in franchise brands. So that was 18 months ago. The fund first closed in December 2014, and so by the time that June 2016 rolled around, in 18 months, we had made two sizable investments and on our way to making several more. In fact, we're about to launch NRD Fund 2 because our pipeline is so robust that we need more capital. So I'm very happy to report and very, you know, fortunate and blessed that the fund has sort of gone according to plan, and the franchisee investors, there are non-franchisee investors as well, but predominantly the investors in our fund are multi-unit franchisees, and they've been very, very happy. In fact, 60 to 70% of our investors in Fund 1 have already indicated that they'll come into Fund 2. So, you know, from that point of view, we're very happy that we've delivered what we promised that we would.
Paul?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Aziz, as I'm listening to you, it seems like I'm going back in my career into franchising, and I didn't even know there was, you know, some parallel here. You know, back in, I forget, it was 91 or 92, as I was president of Atlas Transmission in Houston, Texas, just a small chain, I decided at that time to dedicate myself to really helping, you know, franchisees and franchising in general. And I worked side by side with Steve Hammerstein, a past IFA chairperson, who at the time was president of Quick Copy, and Bud Hadfield, certainly a legacy in franchising, and his group here in Houston. And we trekked back and forth to Austin, and it was the Coalition for Responsible Franchising. And that was when a lot of this stuff was going on in Iowa, and they were going after McDonald's, and that's kind of where some of the dust started getting kicked up on franchise legislation. But while I was going back and forth to Austin on these lobbying efforts, I met several franchisees from Taco Bell and Kentucky Fried Chicken and Pizza Hut. Certainly your circles back then, or a couple of years later was your circles. But anyway, I was amazed at the breadth of their business, because here I was talking to one person that had 42 Taco Bells, and we had 18 of this, and this one had 16 of this and 64 of that. And I remember sitting in a room, and I'm saying, these three gentlemen right here, and it was 30 or 40 other franchisors in the room, I said, they probably have more net worth than everybody in this room put together. And that was the first time that really sent an alarm, and not an alarm, it rang a bell in my mind, and I said, I'm starting to get how this can work down the road. I also, you know, kudos to you, certainly, engineer, entrepreneur. You hear oftentimes that entrepreneurship and engineering don't go side by side. They don't go hand in hand, because a lot of times you hear about engineers, you know, crossing the T's an extra time, dotting the I's an extra time. And I know two of my early partners were NASA engineers. So they were even more ultra conservative and cautious. And I learned a lot from them, and I'm hearing a lot of what you're talking about that I heard from them early on in my career. What I really like that you're doing is seeing this from the franchisee's perspective, from the, what was originally the outside looking in, because as you said, there wasn't a lot of franchisees that got involved in the IFA and franchisor activities. They put their head down and they managed their business. And I've often felt that franchisees really needed to be, you know, part of the equation, so to speak, and what goes on. Matter of fact, a couple of years ago, I wrote an article in Franchising World, Positively Memorable Experiences. It's not just for customers. It is for franchisees, and I really love where this is going. So before we go to the break, if you would, and as we switch gears, and as Stan has us switch gears into the next part of the conversation, I'd like to know a little bit from you and from your experience, how you've encouraged other individuals to become franchisees, because, I mean, you were in there, as you said, you know, mopping floors, probably cleaning toilets at the time, doing everything early on. And there's so many people today that say, you know what, that's not for me. I don't want to do this. So how do you position it to continue to get people interested in franchising, especially since franchising in some circles doesn't have as positive a nomenclature as it probably should?
I think, you know, partly it's we kind of don't have a choice. I think the way that our economy is working and the fact that so many people actually will have to turn to entrepreneurship in order to survive in the future, because their jobs are simply not coming back due to replacement of, you know, due to technology or whatever else may be. I think, and this is why I'm kind of excited to talk about the next segment as well, about, you know, what the IFA is doing, because I think in the world of the future, as we have already transitioned into a service economy, whether our government is able to acknowledge that or not. But, you know, when we have 1 million Uber drivers out there, what are they really? You know, they're just small business people. You know, they're licensees of Uber, really, you know. And so I think that it's a much easier sell today for people to consider franchising than it may have been 10 or 20 years ago, when the stability of a full-time job was a real option for people, where it's not a real option for a lot of people today. That's number one. But number two, on the positive side, is that the diversity of franchising, right? So, you know, there's like 300 different lines in franchising. Mm-hmm. And if one's interest is not quick service restaurants, or you have some issue with fast food or whatever, you know, go open a yoga franchise, go open a gym, go open a hotel. There are so many. If you like pets, go open a pet franchise. If you like sports, go open a sporting goods franchise. I think one of the big, sort of eye-opening moments I have with a lot of people is when I tell them how many different lines of franchising are there out there. And it's interesting that that's actually part of the problem we have in the industry, is that people don't understand that so many of the purveyors that they use every day are actually franchise brands. But when people find out, they say, oh, you mean the gym I go to is actually a franchise? And I say, yeah,
right.
It is, you know, mm-hmm. just because you don't see the franchise. And actually, that's also part of our problem, is that people don't know that it's a franchise and it's probably owned by a local franchisee. But when you first do the education and you tell people that it's not just fast food, you know, that there are so many different franchising opportunities out there in any sphere of your interest. And by the way, if you have an interest that is not franchised, go do it.
Right.
Go create the franchise in that area, you know, if you like it. So it's become a much easier sell today to convince people that if you want financial independence, if you want financial freedom, you want to be your own boss, you know, you can go and open Aziz's chicken shop and probably fail, or you can sign on to a successful franchise business model that has worked. Yeah, you're going to pay a fee for that, but in the long run, you're going to do better because your chances of success are markedly higher than trying to create it yourself. So from that point of view, I'm happy to report that I'm getting a lot more interest from first-time franchisees that just didn't know that options were available. You know,
you're listening to a special edition of Franchise Today, communicating the positive message of franchising with Aziz Hashim. I'm Stan Friedman, along with Paul Segreto, and we're speaking with serial entrepreneur, fast casual czar, multi-unit franchisee, now franchisor, Aziz Hashim, chairman of the IFA. Franchise Today is brought to you by FRM Solutions, offering best-in-class CRM and document management software designed specifically for franchise relationships. FRM solutions are both cloud-based and fully accessible from right inside your Outlook inbox. With FRM, you spend more time focused on your business, while FRM systems effectively manage workflows and collaborative communications with your prospective and existing franchisees. Sort, report, and dashboard all of your vital data, and empower your teams to accelerate franchise sales, streamline store openings, and better manage field ops, unit level economics, and compliance. And now you can manage store and sort all of your text messages with FRM as well as emails. No hassles, no long-term contracts, no excuses, just solutions. FRM Solutions on the web at frmsolutions.com. Franchise Today also brought to you by the Franchise Foundry, with more than 30 years experience helping emerging brands bring sustainable growth to their franchised concepts. Franchise Foundry utilizes a hybrid approach combining both coaching and consultation to foster effective solutions for their clients. Count on the Franchise Foundry for general, business, operational, or change management, digital marketing, and of course, franchise recruitment and development. They can assist you too with mergers and acquisitions. Learn more about the Franchise Foundry and their expanding list of clients at franchisefoundry.com. That's www.franchisefoundry.com. Well, Aziz, this first half hour has just been a breeze. It's flown by, and the second half hour, I'm sure, is going to do the same. But I think we want to pivot some and get the spotlight on the important work that you're doing for the brand that we're all a part of. And I want to open this half just by asking a question, because there are two things that I hear arguments about in franchising all the time. There's a camp that has a problem with calling franchisees partners, and then there's a group of people who take exception to the identification of franchising as an industry when we're only a method of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And even in preparation for today and a lot of the things that I read today that are out there about the work we're doing now together collectively toward franchise, you know, the big party. I like to call it a party, but it's not a party. It's the big fan day getting up to the middle of September up on Capitol Hill. What are your thoughts on that? As an industry, do we call ourselves that properly?
Yeah, I think, you know, so much of life today is semantics.
Yeah.
And they can be important, but I think it's also important not to get too wound up in those. So when we talk about partnership with franchisees, you know, it's a spirit of partnership, right? It's a spirit of collaboration. It's a spirit of respect and knowing that these people have invested money in your brand, and so therefore perhaps you should listen to their voice a little bit. It's not a legal partnership. It's not anything like that, but it's a spirit of partnership. When it comes to a franchise industry, yeah, it's not technically correct to call it an industry because it's not. It's a business model, but it rolls off the tongue a little easier to call it an industry rather than to keep referring to it as business format franchising, which is actually the right terminology to describe what we do, but it's a little bit clunky. And so, but as long as the person using those terminologies knows what, you know, what the underlying meaning is, I think it's okay. But it has caused some confusion in the marketplace. And so I don't get too worked up about people who are trying to correct that, because I think at times we do need to be clear about, you know what we are.
Well, more now than ever.
Absolutely.
We're trying very hard now to put the word out there as to what franchising is and what it does.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in hearing you unpack for us a little bit about what's going to be taking place in just a couple of weeks as we all head up to the Hill for the Franchise Action Network.
Right.
And for years we've been going to this to this, you know, pilgrimage to the Hill, bringing franchisees, encouraging franchisors to bring their franchisees and let the voices of those within the electorate be heard. This year, though, we're carrying a slightly softer, different message, aren't we? And we're going to be talking to these legislators about the positive impact of franchising. Tell us a little bit about what to expect this year.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, out of left field, franchising started experiencing all kinds of attacks. It started in Seattle with just an altogether ridiculous discriminatory minimum wage, where somehow a person with a sandwich shop who may have six employees, but because they're a franchisee of a larger brand, was categorized as a large employer, right? And we said, well, this is odd, very curious, why is this happening? Then a little while later, we start getting hit with joint employer. Then we start getting hit with, you know, ostensible agency, vicarious liability. So over the last couple of years, we have been pummeled by a series of attacks by various forces. And one of the things that I wanted to do as chairman was to kind of get to the root cause of that and say, why would someone attack an industry or a business model franchising which has provided so much opportunity for millions of Americans? So we decided to do some focus groups, some blind tests in four cities to ask ordinary Americans about their view on franchising. And the only thing I can tell you is we were shocked at the skepticism, the general distrust of the general public about franchising from the point of view that they did not believe that franchises could be owned by local families. And that if it says McDonald's on the building, then McDonald's Corporation has something to do with that location, something more than just being a franchisor. The public could not articulate it, but they weren't willing to sort of stipulate that, you know, it's possible that that could be a franchisee, that could be your neighbor in the neighborhood that you live. And so this was the beginning of our understanding as to why we might be attacked. If people don't understand who you are, then they're going to have no sympathy for you. And so what we decided to do is, look, every time someone comes after us, if new law is passed that doesn't make any sense, like joint employer, it's usually symptomatic of a lack of education. And so our goal was that let's, instead of just fighting and screaming at the top of our lungs, et cetera, let's embark upon a massive education program, okay, where people, because from our focus groups, we understood clearly the American public doesn't know what franchising is. And if the American public doesn't know, then legislators are probably not going to know. Then we found out that academics don't know. So we would go to business school deans and we would say, you know, franchising is 4% of the U.S. GDP, employs 11 million people, about $1 trillion of output. Do you know what it is? And they'd say, no, we don't know that. You know, we don't know what franchising is. That was shocking, right? If something is 4% of GDP, you figure there'd be a couple of degrees that could be offered in franchising, you know, and up to very recently, there was no degree you could get in franchising, right? So all of this painted a picture for us that we need to go to the Capitol Hill, and instead of screaming and yelling to people, to legislators, about why are you passing this law and that law, let's start with explaining to them what franchising actually is. How does the model work? Because this has been missing. So we've come up with tools, and we've come up with a website called atourfranchise.org, where the sole purpose of that website is to explain the business format franchising and give resources in the form of PowerPoints, PDFs, animated videos about how franchising really works that can be downloaded and shared with various constituencies. So if you have been asked to give a speech at a Rotary Club, if you've been asked by your kid in high school to come address their class about what you do for a living, wherever venue you may be asked to go, there should be tools that you can take with you. And what I call this work, broadly, is ambassadorship for business format franchising. Right? So if we're sitting in an airplane and we're a franchisee or a franchisor of brand X, and someone, your neighbor sitting next to you in the plane, asks you what you do, the natural reflex response is to talk about the brand. We don't talk about franchising, right? Even if previously when I would sit next to a plane and someone say, what do you do? I would say, well, I'm in Popeyes, I'm in Domino's Pizza, I'm in Subway. And I'd start talking about the brand. I would not explain that I'm a franchisee, and by the way, this is how franchising works, and you should do it, although it only takes a couple minutes. And so, you know, this is what we need to pivot to now, is an education regarding franchising, starting with our legislators, but the big one are our employees. So we have 11 million people whose paychecks we sign in franchising every week, and yet our own employees, for the most part, don't really know who they work for. In fact, I met a franchisee a couple of days ago and said, you know, I don't think my family really understands what I do. Close family, like parents, children. Mm-hmm. Like they know I'm in franchising, but they kind of don't know the relationship, you know, between myself and my franchisor. And so there's widespread misinformation or lack of information about the business model franchising and really the opportunity that it brings. For all this talk about income inequality, which is legitimate, right? I mean, you have to have your head in the sand if you don't understand that there's a growing gap between the rich haves and the have-nots in America. But the solution to the gap, in my view, and this view is clearly not shared by government, is not handouts or wealth transfer, but it's more opportunity, because people really want the dignity of an opportunity. They don't want a handout, most people. And franchising is one of the really few areas in the U.S. economy that's left where you have an opportunity. And I give this example. I say, you know, there's much touted about how we've lost all these middle-class jobs and how all the factory jobs have gone to China and Mexico. And that's all true. But, you know, even if you had a factory job in America and you worked for 40 years, you're never going to own the factory. But by golly, you apply yourself in franchising like I did, for example, you have a real chance to become an owner or at least have a really good career. And I point to a lot of my employees that started with me as hourly workers and today are making six-figure salaries. Some of them don't have college degrees, but they're making like high middle-class salaries.
You've made some millionaires too, haven't you?
Many. And we created a program called Own It where a lot of some 10 of our employees actually went from hourly employees to owning their own franchise because I sold it to them. You know, after they gave me a certain number of years of service. What other industry do you have this? And by the way, I'm not unique in this. Many other franchisees have done that for their employees. So you have this American treasure is what I call franchising, an absolute American treasure, a quintessential American invention. And because we've done such a great job of providing what I call a seamless customer experience, that is, when someone walks into my restaurant, they don't know who the owner is, right? And that's what we wanted. We don't want the customer to feel a difference between a McDonald's in New York versus a McDonald's in Seattle.
We've done too good a job.
We're the victims of our own success. We've done such a great job that most people, most Americans, the general public, actually doesn't know that 90% of franchise units are actually owned by individuals. And everyone thinks that they're owned by the big corporation. And so that is a myth that has to be dispelled. So getting back to the FAN conference in a couple of weeks, that's our opportunity as franchisees to come to D.C. for just a day, day or two, and go up to Capitol Hill, and we make all the arrangements for you. And the staff at the IFA does a fabulous job. They know where you, if you give them your address, they know where you live and therefore who your representative is, and they actually make appointments for people. And you go to the Hill and just explain your story. That's just tell them what franchising has done for you and why you're so blessed to have been in franchising and why the government should protect franchising, it should enhance franchising, it should really foster it so that it becomes a bigger opportunity for more and more Americans, because this is like the last place, you know, in terms of, you know, having a chance to rise up the ladder and the upward that we provide. And the examples I gave of my employees, some of them, you know, six-figure salaries without a high school diploma, I don't know any other industry in America where you cannot have, forget about college degree, you may not have a high school diploma, but by working hard, you can make really good salary for yourself and your family. And so this has to be communicated to our lawmakers at all costs. And the way to do it is to come to our fan conference, participate, and go tell stories. And, you know, we entrepreneurs, again, as I said at the beginning of this, we get so busy in our day-to-day lives that we feel that we can't make the time. But, you know, if we don't make the time, we're likely to get even more attacks on our business model, which will just, it's not going to destroy franchising, but it's going to take away the opportunity for those who have yet not been able to avail of it. And that would be a shame. Like the opportunity that I got and that you got, Paul, and you, Stan, to make it in this business as a supplier or as a franchisor or as a franchisee, we're just taking that opportunity away from our next generation. And that's a waste. You know, we just can't allow that to happen. And so the fan conference then becomes critically important. That's the one day a year we get to go to the Hill and tell our story.
Paul?
Yeah, we definitely do need to. It's interesting, you know, you mentioned about, you know, even the academics don't know much about franchising. Quick story, Stan knows it. I'm not sure if you're aware. 5 years ago, I was promoting Small Business Saturday, American Express's annual event, to really promote small business, you know, Main Street USA. And I was promoting it to my clients and told them to tell their franchisees to get involved. And one of the franchisees came back to me and showed me the Small Business Saturday agreement, and it excluded franchising at the time. And I was appalled. I just couldn't believe it. And I was trying to call somebody at American Express, which, of course, you can imagine how that went. And I tried emails, and I tried all. So I turned to social media, and I had quite a robust bit of activity going on that was noticed by writers at the Wall Street Journal and Inc. magazine and Entrepreneur magazine and some local magazines, and had quite a few interviews and was on TV and radio, and still American Express was silent, and I was blogging about it. And Thanksgiving came and went, and of course the day after Thanksgiving, a Small Business Saturday, and on Black Friday, still no response from them. And finally on Small Business Saturday, I just sent out a tweet that says, maybe franchising needs to stop taking the American Express card. And I got a message through Twitter from a senior VP at American Express to call her. And I called her and she said, please stop. And I explained, I said, we're small business just like any other mom and pop. These are life savings invested. We're on Main Street, USA. And we had a series of meetings afterwards. I was with 19 senior executives from American Express on conference call, people from all over the United States, including two of the people that basically founded Small Business Saturday. Aziz, they didn't have a clue. They thought franchising was McDonald's. They thought franchisees had an advantage because McDonald's put their money into the marketing for the franchisees. And I was amazed. I said, you're here with master's degrees and MBAs and everything else. You don't understand what franchising is. Boy, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And, of course, since then, it's been getting better and better. The next year, it was, you know, brands with 50 units, 100 units. I think right now it's 150 or 200 units. Still not completely there. I will continue those efforts on American Express and get people to remind them that franchising is every much small business as every other mom and pop. So as we have maybe about 8 or 9 minutes before the end of the show, Stan, where do you want to go from here? What would you like Aziz to let us know and let our listeners know as this event is coming up in September?
I think that it's critically important for us at this juncture, Aziz, to make certain franchisors and franchisees understand the landscape of what we're going to be doing, not just up on the Hill with our legislators, but same as we've given some focus to the At Our Franchise, what about Franchising Gives Back? Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And then maybe just a quick review of what the agenda is for the couple of days, because there are franchisee summits too. There's an awful lot of intellectual capital. Those Brian Schnell nuggets
yes.
are going to be offered to franchisees who attend.
Yeah, absolutely. Once these attacks started to happen, you know, one of the things we decided to do at the IFA was catalog all the ways in which franchising gives back to local communities, right? Because here's another example where when the local Little League team needs to do a car wash, right, where are they going? You know, they're coming to a franchisee and saying, can we use your parking lot, you know?
Absolutely.
When there's, you know, any kind of need that a small local high school or Little League team or the Boy Scouts or whatever needs, they come to their franchisees in the neighborhood, right? And so all of this great work is going on all over America, and yet we get no credit for it. Not that we're doing it for credit, but if we're going to be attacked,
sure.
By these forces, then we also need to fight back and say, hey, do you have any idea what the sort of community involvement we have and how much we do? And so Franchising Gives Back was a really creative way to actually honor people who give back and to highlight and showcase and actually have an award for the best ways in which people have done community service in franchising. And so we have an annual banquet at the fan meeting every year, so we'll have it again this year as well, where we award to the top endeavors in giving back that we can. It's so exciting because some of the work these brands do is just unbelievable, and these franchisees, it's the immense amount of time and resources that local franchisees put into their communities to help their communities grow. So that's one thing. Also, you know, it's very important that franchisees get content. And so, therefore, at the fan meeting, we have now beefed up the content for franchisees because we want their time there to be worthwhile. Going on the Hill is actually an exceedingly exciting experience, but we want to add more value. And so we're adding more value through this Franchisee Power Summit, where we're going to have all kinds of content on how to better run and manage your business as a franchisee from just like top-notch speakers and whatnot. So that's going to happen at the same time as well. So it's going to be a really packed 2 or 3 days in Washington, D.C. at the JW Marriott Hotel there. And anyone who comes, I guarantee you, any franchisee who attends, you will get so much for your time and your money it's almost unquantifiable what the benefits are of this 2 days, spending just 2 days. I mean, literally, you can mark out an itinerary where you only wound up spending one night, you know, in Washington, D.C. It'd be a bit of a push, but you could do it. If you spent 2 nights, it would be fantastic, you know, 2.5 days or so. So I encourage everyone to go onto the Franchisee Action Network website or the IFA website can link to it as well. Go to the At Our Franchise website and find out about all of these activities and come down and spend a couple of days in Washington and come with us to Capitol Hill. Come with us to the Franchising Gives Back Awards and come to the Power Summit and really educate yourself and get benefits for yourself and to help protect franchising, because that's the one common mission that we all have. Whether you're a supplier or a franchisee or a franchisor, protecting the business model, I think, is absolutely the first order of business for all of us. And this is the place where we can all join hands and do it together. So it's very, very worthwhile.
It was 6 months ago, Aziz, you took the gavel,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to fathom that you're halfway through that term already.
I'll tell you, it's time flies when you're having fun.
And you, your first mission as a chairman of the IFA, as I recall, was being hijacked by yours truly and taking you up to Kennesaw State.
I'll tell you.
To speak to some young entrepreneurs, wannabes, and existing entrepreneurs.
And I think it was a pleasure to do it for you, Stan, and I encourage that all of us in franchising take these opportunities, whatever they're given, to spread the message, you know, and to be ambassadors for franchising. Yeah, it's great to be an ambassador for your brand, but don't forget about being an ambassador for the business model, because that's where the problem lies today. In fact, in those same blind focus groups, people generally had a high opinion of brands. They just didn't believe in, they didn't believe that there could be franchisees.
Right.
In fact, people told us, I was in the one that was in Atlanta, and people said, look, when I'm on a road trip with my family going to Disneyland or whatever, I'm going to stop at a McDonald's because I trust that they're going to have clean restrooms. I know what the food quality is going to be. I trust that. The part they didn't trust was that that same McDonald's which you're stopping your family with could be owned by a franchisee, and that's the problem. So, you know, we've done a great job in brand development and delivering on a customer promise as a brand, but what we haven't done a great job is explaining how franchise business model works and what a franchisee is and what a great opportunity it is for someone who wants to be in business for themselves but not by themselves, and that is franchising.
In the closing seconds, Aziz, we have a major election coming up later this year, and no matter the outcome, I feel it's important that we impart a message from your view. No matter who wins, no matter what happens, that we don't lose hope in our business model and that we continue to stay the course and do what we always do, we adjust. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, and I've said this actually publicly on TV on Fox News, is that regardless of who wins the election, what either side in power needs to understand is that what's missing in America today is opportunity equality. That's what's missing, and if you believe that opportunities, and both sides say this, they give lip service to it, that we want to create more opportunities. If you really want to create more opportunities, franchising is by far the best way in America to create opportunities for everyone, not just a few elite rich people, but everybody from the hourly employee like me, who at the age of 14 was mopping floors and became one of the largest franchisees in America. I did not have a silver spoon. It was all through the promise of franchising, and that's the message. Franchising equals opportunities.
I have always said to those that I speak to about franchising, it doesn't take $1 million to get your first franchise started, but get started on your first franchise so you can go to work on your first million.
There you got it.
Aziz Hashim, can't tell you what a pleasure it has been to have you with us here.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Franchise Today.
Appreciate it.
Paul?
Thank you, Aziz. Franchise Today airs live every Wednesday, 11 a.m. Central, 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Remember, all shows are available on demand on Blog Talk Radio and on iTunes. So until then, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best from Stan and I in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is